and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Bonnie Christian, a journalist, author, and fellow at Defense Priorities. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to start by asking you about U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. She's the highest ranking official to go there for 25 years or something. But there's probably some important context we need before we get to your analysis. This wasn't merely a first shot. There was a big lead up. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, so she sort of floated the idea a couple weeks ago, suggesting she might go there while touring Asia. And then as she started on her trip, it was not initially included in her itinerary. So there was a lot of debate, will she or won't she? And while that was going on, we learned that the Biden administration opposed her going. President Biden said, you know, the military doesn't think this is a good idea right now, and you know, publicly spoke against it. We've since learned that privately behind the scenes, administration officials were advising her against going. And China, of course, publicly was vociferously condemning the idea, you know, talking about how their military would not sit idly by if she came, and casting it generally as a threat to their sovereignty if she went to Taiwan, which of course they claim control over, even though in practice that control doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I mean, the context is important. We can't go through the whole history. It's a very long history with Taiwan, but I mean, you know, for 40 years or so, we've had agreements promising not to try to alter the status quo. There have been crises since sort of Eisenhower. In the post-Cold War period, Clinton and Bush had crises and kind of face-down moments over Taiwan. I think Trump's first act in office, or actually rather as president-elect, was to take a congratulatory phone call from the Taiwanese leader. And then, you know, the Taiwan Travel Act of 2018, Congress passed this thing which explicitly authorized high-level U.S.-Taiwanese meetings, which was not an insignificant change, which is a pretty clear message from Washington, D.C., that we're no longer going to kind of exercise the restraint and respect for China's territorial sensitivities that we once did. And I believe there were some previous delegations of U.S. senators and so on that went. So this was a kind of long ratchet. What has the fallout been since she's visited? What has China's reactions been?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit difficult to say, you know, to wholly place the blame on Pelosi's trip and say they did this because she came. However, it seems pretty clear that a lot of what they're doing is certainly strongly connected, even if that's not the only reason. So one thing, for example, is the Taiwanese government reported that Chinese warplanes were flying into, not directly over the island, I believe, but into the airspace that they consider, you know, sort of their zone. That is something that Chinese warplanes do with some regularity. So it wasn't, you know, again, it wasn't a wholly new thing because of Pelosi's visit, but they sent a larger contingent of planes than they normally do. So it you know, it's hard to say this isn't a reaction. There have also been some economic consequences. Beijing has slapped some new sanctions on Taiwan. They've banned some imports, I believe mostly of baked goods from Taiwan. And then the biggest thing, of course, is these live fire military exercises that began today, Thursday, local time, which some of them are quite close to the Taiwanese beaches. I believe the closest one is within about 10 miles off the shore. And they have not done drills like this for nearly 30 years, since, like, I believe it's 1995, 1996. Is the last time that the Chinese military got so close with these live fire exercises.
So there was a lot of pushback. She got pushback from the president of her own party. She got pushback diplomatically. Some U.S. allies in the region, Australia, Japan, didn't really appreciate this, and they kind of viewed it as at the very least a snub, and at the very worst sort of unnecessarily causing instability. And it became kind of politicized, and people started taking sides. It became about standing up for democracy or the credibility of U.S. commitments and all sorts of things. So what do you think actually prompted her to do this? Why go for Pelosi?
Yeah, it's hard to say. She published that op-ed in the Washington Post this week, which very much leaned into the, you know, we're defending democracy arguments, to the point that her closing line very nearly committed the United States to fighting for any democracy anywhere. It just went very hard in the "this is about democracy" direction. But, you know, you could do that on the phone. So it's hard to really credit that as a serious reason for why she went. I think, and this sounds cynical, but I think the most likely reason is that, you know, she's nearing retirement. She's expected to lose the speakership in November. It's sort of something of a last hurrah, perhaps, where she does have this long record of critiquing and rightly critiquing the Chinese government. And so, you know, I think she wanted to continue in that vein. And, you know, I don't think it was prudent for her to go. I think it's sort of strange that she went in defiance, as you said, of a president of her own party. Certainly she has a right to go. Congress is a co-equal branch. But yeah, it seems to me arguably self-serving more than anything else.
So a lot of the experts, I think, predicted that this would cause a lot of instability and kind of tick China off, to put it technically. Did we gain anything? I mean, has any part of the situation improved? Is there any kind of benefit to U.S. interests at all?
I don't really think so. To my mind, it was a lot of risk, not really any reward. I have seen some commentators saying, well, you know, China is accidentally doing us a favor by doing these live fire exercises. They're sort of giving us a preview of what their strategy would be if they were to try to invade Taiwan. Maybe that's true. I don't really feel qualified to judge that question. But outside that possibility, no, it seems to me that compared to last week, Taiwan is under more economic sanctions and hardship, and things are less stable and less secure than they were before.
What about the implications of doing this, you know, kind of poking Beijing in the eye about one of its most sensitive and vital national interests, while we're also intervening in the near abroad of another major power, Russia, over territory and over stakes that Russia sees as vital in Ukraine?
Yeah, there's been so much talk in recent years about pivoting from, you know, trying to sort of control the whole Middle East and war on terror stuff to great power conflict. And there's a way in which that is sensible, in that what we were doing in the Middle East was not good, was not, you know, helpful to us, was not helpful to them. And, you know, we do have, particularly in China, a rising great power, and we should be paying attention to that. But there's a difference between, I think, pivoting to pay attention to that and winding down wars in the Middle East as compared to actively courting, like, open conflict with China and Russia as well. Particularly, as you mentioned, over things that they view as core to their national interest, and that are just objectively not core to our national interests. You know, I mean, I do not want Ukraine to be invaded by Russia. I don't want Taiwan to be invaded by China. But the United States is not imperiled if that happens. You know, we are not any less secure right now. In terms of, this is not an existential threat to us that there's this war in Ukraine. And in the same way, it wouldn't be an existential threat to us that if there was war in Taiwan. And it would be tragic, it would be wrong, but it's not an existential threat to us. And so, yeah, I think it's deeply unwise for us to be provocative towards what are objectively, especially in China's case, maybe not quite peers, but certainly the closest thing we have to military peers on the planet and you know, nuclear nations with whom, you know, sort of like the unthinkable civilization-ending war could happen.
So we're still seeing the consequences of Pelosi's Taiwan visit unfold. We don't know what will follow. But with respect to the war in Ukraine, you've written recently that Biden was right to pledge, with a clarity too often lacking in his policy toward Ukraine, that the United States will not be directly engaged in this conflict. Can you talk a bit about the tension between his pledge and his policy?
Yeah, so he's very much framed his policy about, you know, if they do not attack us, if they being Russia, if Russia does not attack us, if they do not attack our allies, we are not going to go to war with them. And that's, you know, that's a good thing. I think that's exactly the promise he should be making. But in practice, it's not a bright line, right? Like, the things that we are doing in Ukraine at this point, the way that we are supplying weapons, the way that we are supplying advice and intelligence. There were those two leaked stories to the New York Times from anonymous U.S. officials about how we helped kill some Russian generals and we helped sink the Russian warship. You know, these are arguably, we are already involved in that war against Russia. Certainly, I think we would see those acts as acts of war, certainly very warlike acts if we were on the receiving end. And so, you know, he drew this bright line rhetorically, which is a good thing. And I would rather have that statement than not. But in practice, it has not been as bright as it is in his rhetoric.
What do you think Moscow's objectives are in this war? And are those achievable aims?
Yeah, so the big recent news and the sort of the what prompted that article that you quoted from was the statement from their foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, that he openly stated that what Russia intends to do in Ukraine is regime change. And from at the beginning of the war, they were explicitly denying that. They were saying, you know, that's not our plan. We're not trying to occupy Ukraine. We're not trying to, you know, take away their statehood or overthrow the government. And now Moscow has said, yes, that's what we're doing. Whether it's achievable, it's so hard to say. I mean, at the beginning, everyone expected a much quicker war than this. Thought Russia would just sort of roll through, given the comparative size of their military, and obviously that hasn't proven to be the case. So whether they are capable of, you know, ousting the Zelensky government, taking Kyiv, I don't know. I guess at this point I wouldn't be surprised either way. But the question with regime change is always what comes next. And this is a question that the United States has of course learned at great cost over the past two decades. You know, just because you can throw out the old government doesn't mean that you can successfully make a new one, doesn't mean that you can keep the new one going, doesn't mean that you'll ever get buy-in from the local population. So, you know, in that sense, I think the goal is not realistic, particularly given the response among the Ukrainian public to the invasion. I don't, you know, maybe they do take Kyiv. I don't really see them ever having a compliant population that supports the new regime.
Yeah, and I imagine Moscow knows that, and maybe some of its rhetoric has exceeded its actual war aims. But even if it's just a kind of break up the country's eastern territory to Russian control or de facto Russian control, his point will have been made. He sees it, I think, on Ukraine's potential future inclusion into NATO, which, of course, we've been teasing for a long time. How do you see the Biden administration's policy on this going forward? Is it just going to continue to support at somewhat low levels? Or are there escalatory risks?
Yeah, that's difficult to say. I mean, we have, it was in May, if I recall correctly, May or June, that they started sending these HIMARS and you know, sort of upping the level of support that we've provided in terms of weaponry. And recently, I don't remember if it was in direct response to the Lavrov comments about regime change or just sort of coincidental, I've seen some renewed pushes to provide Ukraine with jets, fighter jets, with planes. I don't believe we've done planes so far. Not planes that we would fly ourselves by the U.S. military, but to sell or give planes to them. So I think that sort of escalation seems very plausible. We're upping the sort of level of weaponry that we're providing. There's also been pushes for more, you know, intelligence sharing, or even for like an advise and assist mission, the sort of thing that we do a lot in North Africa, elsewhere in the Middle East, where we're sending in American officers or sort of like elite groups of American troops to train and offer more direct guidance. Now, given those leaks again to the Times about helping sink the ship and kill the generals, we're clearly doing some advising already, but that was supposed to be secret. So a more open and large scale advise and assist mission, I think, would be an escalation and doesn't seem inconceivable. But at some point, you know, I think even the Biden administration would have to recognize how blurry that line of we're not going to get directly involved would become. And so, yeah, it's hard to say exactly where they'll decide we have to stop here.
Just to zoom out again and go back to that earlier point about kind of taking on both China and Russia at the same time and refusing to withdraw from the Middle East and so on. I wonder if you have anything to say about the, I think still somewhat understated, but if not predictable, thing where there's this remarkable consistency between the foreign policies of Trump and Biden. There's a difference in presentation and in rhetoric, but just like with Bush and Obama, the continuities are pretty substantial. Do you have anything to say about that? Such not just the two parties, but at a time of incredible partisanship and kind of division, and the distinction between the two candidates is certainly very wide. Why not their foreign policy?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I don't know if it's possible to pinpoint a single reason. A great deal of it, I suspect, is inertia, institutional inertia, just the difficulty of getting out of these long-term, projects and commitments that we have, and just the simple matter of fear. You know, I think we particularly in the Middle East and anything to do with the war on terror, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, we really bought into that the mindset of that George W. Bush phrase was so well known about, you know, we have to fight them over there so we don't fight them over here. It's this sense of if we stop doing this that we've done for so long, won't it get worse? Like, won't we have another 9/11? Can we really give these things up? And, you know, people say it'll be okay, but can we take that risk? I think that's a lot of it. Beyond that, you know, I mean, the Pentagon is a huge organization. There's a lot of moving pieces here. It's very hard to undo huge government bureaucracies and programs once they're in place. And we've all sort of become accustomed to this baseline level of bases overseas and military interventions that sort of teeter on the edge of are they or are they not wars? And this idea that it is the right and natural thing to have the United States sort of militarily dominate the planet and have a global sphere of influence, not just something regional. And those are very strong assumptions. They're assumptions on both sides of the aisle, and they create conditions where it sort of just becomes unthinkable to significantly depart from that, even if you're layering on top quite different rhetoric and in some cases meaningful differences. You know, I think things about like rules for civilian casualties, like that is a significant difference, and you know, I don't want to gloss over that, but in terms of like the big picture, you're right, it doesn't change very much. And I think we are at the national level not even very good at talking about what is a markedly different way that we could do this.
We've discussed issues of executive power, presidential power on this show before, particularly in the domain of foreign and national security policy. This is something you've written recently about as well, especially with respect to national emergency declarations. You wrote, if you'll excuse me, quote, "Emergency declarations have become a lazy political workaround, a way for presidents to bypass Congress after it fails to do its job, or in some cases outright rejects what the president wants. National emergencies have become a loophole to administrative lawlessness, and they are in dire need of reform." Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so national emergencies as we know them now come from the National Emergencies Act of 1976. And the way it's designed, it's supposed to be a way for the president to act under situations of true emergency where Congress does not have time to meet and take a vote, you know, perhaps even in scenarios where we've got members of Congress shuttled off to different safe locations or something, like they can't gather together. And so then it has a time limit and says, you know, after, I believe it's 6 months, if I recall correctly, Congress has to approve the thing the president did under the national emergency. But the idea is like when things are really crazy, there's just no time. The federal government is not hamstrung by the inability to get Congress together. The way it has worked in practice, though, is that it frequently concerns things that are not true emergencies. Presidents use it to expand their powers when Congress has had plenty of time to act. And they often use it for things that are, you know, don't even really concern the United States. It's not national in that sense. So in that article, two examples I used is we have ongoing national emergencies that have been in place since the George W. Bush administration. Biden re-upped them in the last year or two. And they're both about sanctioning people who are meddling in democratic processes in Zimbabwe and Belarus. Like, these are not, they're just not national emergencies to the United States. Like, they're bad. They're not our national emergencies. Congress could have done something if they wanted to. They were not under any constraints. And so I think in recent years, there's been a little bit more attention to the misuse of national emergencies because Donald Trump wanted to declare a national emergency to get funds for his border wall after Congress had explicitly declined to provide that funding. And then most recently, we saw there was a report that President Biden was considering the same thing around climate change because the Senate was not reaching a deal on climate change legislation. And in both cases, they explicitly phrased it as, if Congress doesn't do the thing I want, I'm going to have to declare a national emergency. And that very phrasing reveals that the conditions for declaring a national emergency haven't been met. But because the law is, I guess, written loosely enough, and that 6-month time limit for Congress to sign off on things is quite long, presidents are able to do this and get away with it and just sort of take lawmaking powers into their own hands.
These specific kinds of declarations are really a reflection of a broader problem with the expansion of executive power over time, and most importantly for this show, war powers in particular. We still have authorizations for the use of military force, for example, to pursue terrorists or alleged terrorists abroad. It's not really constrained by any borders or anything else, really, time limits. Do you want to say anything about executive war powers specifically and how that continues to characterize the U.S. war on terror, as we've just seen with the recent Zawahiri killing?
Yeah. So, you know, the post 9/11 authorizations for use of military force for Afghanistan and Iraq are the two that have been, I think, most abused in terms of there's just no limits of chronology or geography. And so the Afghanistan one in particular has been used to go after groups that are not in Afghanistan and that formed after the 9/11 attacks happened. So they can't be responsible for these attacks because they didn't exist at the time. So Congress doesn't repeal these. They don't pass new ones. They just sort of let them be stretched beyond all reasonable understanding of the authorization as it was originally written. And you end up with these sort of blanket permission for the president to order airstrikes or even boots on the ground really just about anywhere, because once the interpretation of an authorization for use of military force has been stretched so much, at a certain point, it just becomes, a carte blanche for whatever they're inclined to do. And that's what we've seen in recent years, such that we have, again, it's hard to know, should we call it a war? But we have certainly, like, you know, military interventions, warlike activities in so many countries. It's the bulk of the countries in Africa and small presences still in a lot of the Middle East, even though we've wound down combat missions.
You know, it's a bit ironic because I think it's clear, if you know a little bit about American history, that the constitutional provision providing Congress with the ability to determine the nation's hostilities in war was to prevent exactly this kind of problem. They were trying to set up checks and balances and sort of use the incentive structures against each branch of government against each other. But the problem is both branches, the legislative and executive, are very supportive of this expansive view of executive power and war power in particular. So No presidential candidate seems to want to run their campaign on a message of, I'm going to reduce the power of the office that I'm seeking. That's a very odd thing. We wouldn't hear that. But then there are many examples where the president, for one reason or another, wants to take a more cautious approach, maybe a more diplomatic approach, and Congress kind of bullies and forces the issue to a much more rightward, hawkish, confrontational turn. So the checks and balances are kind of broken there, no?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and look at the, we have diaries, I believe, from, I want to say John Adams or Madison, on, you know, the deliberations while they were working on the Constitution. And they really got into it over exactly what phrasing should be used when crafting the war powers. And it's clear from the discussion, the notes from the discussion, that their goal was to slow the rush to war, to make it more difficult to declare war, and then, you know, not require Congress to be involved to end a war. You know, the president should just be able to leave if he thinks it's done. They wanted to be, make it hard to start and easy to leave. And in what we have now is very much the other way around, where it's very easy for the president to claim authorization under one of these never repealed AUMFs, and then we just sort of never go home. Or if we, even if we do end combat operations as we did in Iraq, there's like still some very hard to find number of U.S. forces there. Afghanistan is sort of like the rare exception at this point, where it was a complete exit. But again, as with this recent strike, like we are still to some degree involved there, and I don't really see under what circumstance that would end for the foreseeable future, because Congress certainly isn't going to say you've got to stop getting involved.
Not so much for ending on a hopeful note. Bonnie Christian, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.